You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Naturalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and it's the 16th of November, 2022. I should warn you in advance, by the way, that I have two misbehaving dogs behind me. And so if you hear anything crazy, they're responsible for it. This may be a problem from here. In fact, it's been a problem in the past, will be a problem in the future. Unlike the cats, they're not working for anybody. They're just badly behaved. Cats have an agenda. Anyway, speaking of which, we're going to talk about, I guess, what you consider the opposite of the American system of government, and that is the Byzantine system of government in the middle of the Macedonian period. We're talking about roughly the turn of the first millennium. So, as always, the distinction, the master distinction, is monarchy versus oligarchy, naturalism versus oligarchy, and in terms of internal politics. And one of the justifications of monarchy is to have a center of power that's stronger than big money. Or in this case, landholding, which was the dominant way. This was oligarchy was manifest at the time. And then that relationship connected to the Muslim world and the end of the Khazar era, the Black Sea, as well as we're going to mention the Himyarite kingdom in the Middle East, which was also a Jewish kingdom made up of converts who had everything to do with not so much the creation of Islam, but the promotion and the rule of Islam over the Middle East, especially Saudi Arabia, where some of the Himyarite families were the dominant oligarchs of the area. So I mentioned the Macedonian dynasty, primarily because it was one of the high points of Byzantine society, culture, and the empire, specifically the rule of Basil II, who I've always pointed to as one of the greatest monarchs of all time. He didn't end it, of course, but he was the dominant figure, dying in 1025. But there's a lot of antecedents to this. Saint Nikephoros Phokas, or Nikephoros II Phokas, who died in 969, is also one of the dominant personalities of the Macedonian era. Romanos II died at age 26 under mysterious circumstances. A lot of these guys will also die under mysterious circumstances. Basil II and Constantine VIII were just babies at the time. And so the Senate had declared them co-emperors under a regent. And that regent, we'll talk about in a little bit, is a oligarch. Nikephoros Phokas, in the great Roman tradition, was a successful general. And he was proclaimed emperor by the army. Again, it's a very, very Roman thing to do, and appointed John Zimisces, the chief of staff in the East. He will eventually become John I. But it was Brengas, who was the eunuch, who was a caretaker of the throne when they were 3-4 years old, was working for the senatorial oligarchy. He was unpopular. He tried to hold on to power as regent, as Nikephoros was growing in popularity. But in this period of time, of course, Islam is continuing to grow. They have taken much of Sicily. This was a huge challenge and actually ultimately a failure for Nikephoros. But it was the Sicilians themselves that called for a Byzantine invasion because in union with the Jews of the island, Islam had declared jihad on especially the Greeks. Remember, South Italy was mostly Greek in this period of time. And it was, in fact, the Byzantine fleet that was defeated in one of these very rare defeats. We talked about Greek fire in the past, but they had developed some significant countermeasures, including the use of a very early form of frogmen that were able to tip over and get rid of the ammunition, these cauldrons where the chemical could be found. And so they developed tactics against Greek fire. And the jihad against Byzantium in Italy led to the wiping out of Christian populations there. Not to mention the fact that he also had Otto the First to contend with in the north, but that was a far more minor problem. We've gone into great length over the years on the Byzantine throne and what it means. And, you know, the idea of a medieval king, I should say medieval emperor, is military, which is why it's not, you know, loony for a general to be proclaimed. In fact, the whole justification for royal power was, at least when it comes to the external world, the military defense of the empire. And someone who was successful on the battlefield was this kind of a primordial drive that human beings have, was seen as a legitimate ruler. And Nikephoros ultimately, I mean, the Macedonian dynasty was for the most part successful in this respect. But Byzantium, to understand Byzantium was one of the center of the world at the time, the center of Greek culture at the time and Christian Europe at the time, and still remains the standard today, as the Russians took very seriously. Fighting on multiple fronts was the norm. And fighting on multiple fronts against an increasingly powerful, wealthy opponent, the caliphates especially, in the east, the remnant of the Khazar Empire, but even the Bulgarians and the very early Kievans. They eventually became a part of the Commonwealth, of course, but that took a while, let alone the Western issues. So multiple fronts, and then maintaining the economy necessary to create the infrastructure for this military apparatus. And not just military, but, you know, their proto-industrial, you know, weapons making and food production. This is not just important, this is critical. This is what the empire was, you know, how it defends itself. Oligarchy actually came from military-connected landowners. And this is why the bourgeois and Judaic idea of commerce was always looked down upon, and why the Talmud and many other Jewish sources just loathe anything having to do with Rome and the idea of a land empire. Because what matters are really the martial virtues, and that goes for the ascetic life in the church too. It's the martial virtue, that they call it the arena. But that's just against invisible enemies as well as your own passions. While what the empire, what the emperor does is against the visible enemies. And so much of the ascetic writing that we've talked about is, you know, connecting those two things. So Cilicia, which is an Armenian area, fell to the Greeks in the east. The war in 964-5 in Syria. And the brother of Nikephoros, Leophokos, was also a successful general. It's also this period of time that you have parts of Georgia and Armenia voluntarily coming under Byzantine control. Later on, it would be Russian control. And under Nikephoros, much of, at least part of North Africa and much of the Middle East was recaptured. Importantly, Antioch was taken in 968. Antioch being the major city of the East in Syria, a heavily Greek city. a very Orthodox city, but because of its money, attracted the Jewish, even native Jewish elements there. So clearly, Nikephoros became more and more popular as time went on. The monarchy was always popular. The only time it wanes in popularity is from military defeat or an arbitrary exaction of taxes. But even that mostly comes from oligarchy, not the monarchy. And here, of course, because of all of this, the entire economy was mobilized for warfare. Army spending, because, you know, they're always outnumbered, multiple fronts. Almost the entire economy is aimed towards financing this. You know, that was the whole point of the central government. You know, the central government for fighting external enemies, the Patriarchate and the big monastery for fighting the internal enemies, both, you know, psychological and domestic. And so army spending was very high, and he had to cut back on other forms of spending. And taxes had to be, you know, taxes often were enforced on occasion, but now they had to be tightened up. And despite him being a saint, he had no choice but to tax the clergy and removed some of the monastic immunities. Despite him being an actual ascetic, he forbade the founding of any new monasteries for a short time, because every bit of the empire had to be mobilized directly for warfare. And the other issue that the religious issue of the time was the idea of martyrdom. You know, the iconoclastic period in Byzantium was influenced to a great extent by the defeats that the Byzantines suffered on the battlefield with the Muslims. You know, Islam, Judaism in its various forms are very close, and they work together from day one. And, you know, groups like the Paulicians, who John I very soon will defeat, these are all ways of infiltration. You didn't have really a media at the time. So creating these sects, heavily influenced by various forms of Judaism, is how they fought the information war back then. He also had to debase the currency. But as far as the martyrs go, Nikephoros was very interested in seeing if soldiers fallen in battle could be called martyrs. And I say this because this is the Islamic idea. The church rejected it. And I think they rejected it for a very good reason. It was because, you know, you have to take things on a case-by-case basis. What is the motivation of someone going off to war? Is it to defend the church, or is it for some other reason? You can't give a blanket martyric appellation to these people. But in the liturgy itself, and the petitions are for the armed forces. That petition in the liturgy probably shouldn't be said today. That's not just for any armed forces. The church cannot pray for the victory of the American armed forces, because that's the opponent of everything Christian, let alone Orthodox. We should not be doing that. Praying specifically for Russian military forces might be appropriate. But this was for this, you know, this particular idea that the health of the empire depended on whether or not Muslims and other groups would be kept at bay. And Archbishop Auxentius of Athens used to say that the great walls of Constantinople are a metaphor for doctrine. I think I've said that in the past. So it's critical for those walls to be maintained. Literal walls of Byzantium. But it was Michael Borchis who took Antioch. And unfortunately, he did it. The argument is that he took it without orders. He was told to stand down, and despite being successful, he attacked the city anyway. And that was we'll talk about this a bit more in a minute, but Michael and John, became John I, were exiled. The significance there is that Nikephoros' wife was possibly having an affair with John. because he was an ascetic, sexuality didn't attract him very much. And at the time, things were a bit different than today. You don't have a sexualized society. But at a minimum, she permitted his murder, and possibly murdered by who eventually became John the First, who died in 976. So the metaphors here are pretty clear. The walls, the military, for external and occasionally internal fighting. The Passons representing the oligarchs. And all three of these people, Nikephoros, John, and Basil, spent a huge... In fact, their victories abroad were prefaced on their victories at home, because these wars were expensive. Now, they ended up paying for themselves, just like old Rome, but that's far from guaranteed at the time. The good news for Byzantium in this period of time was that the Abbasid Caliphate was breaking up. And, you know, in the 960s, you know, that John, who became emperor possibly through poisoning, helped Nikephoros take the throne, and then, as we said, was eventually disgraced. But he defeated the force, the militia from Aleppo, which was attacking the empire, and that pretty much solidified it. They understood what would happen. I'll do a show on what happened after the fall of Byzantium and, soon. But military victory does solidify one's position. So he also defeated Svatoslav. We talked about this. Coalitions, founded by a guy. And as all, you know, they are always pro-Islam, so that by their very structure, and rejected the Judaized movements, rejected. Stood everything that the Old Testament talks about at great length. It's meant to take the fangs out of the Christian empire and to create interpretation of the New Testament only, reducing the church. Now, their defeat, both internally and externally, was extremely important because they were lavish the Judaizers in Russia. It's really one and the same semi-Judaic propaganda outlet. Again, that was their media. Because of their wealth, because of their connection to science, is although they're romanticized beyond belief. And their ideology was well known. It's even stated in a deceptive way. This was the old Protestant idea of bringing the church to its true foundation. Prefaced on the rejection of the Old Testament. The evil of rejecting the Old Testament is one of the things that typifies Judaizing movements. Jews have always condemned not just, you know, Christ and Mary are in hell, but so are the prophets, because they dared to criticize Israel. Now, the seat, to some extent, the Senate body, and in Byzantium, it changed its form to some extent. It didn't have a great civil wars. Between oligarchic groups, and especially their wars against the empire itself, became more and more violent. There's nothing that's going to destroy the empire more quickly than civil war and a revolution internally. Revolution at the time was simply the rule of the oligarchs. It had limited power, but because a lot of people there, and there was no, it wasn't a strict appointment election, it was really just it was very much ad hoc. Constantine initially tried to bring them into Constantinople by free grants of land and things like that. But again, Constantius II brought it up to almost 3,000 members. some of the elites of the empire. They did pass resolutions, and you find in the law codes, you do hear things like orations from the Senate. This is, a fact file. I don't want to exaggerate it, but and to some extent as a court of law. That was the case under Peter in the Russian Empire as well. Phocas and John and Basil, it was just a place for rich people to talk. But because of that, it did have reputation. But the Civil War is one of the things, the reign of the great Saint Basil, I'm sorry, not Saint. Nikephoros is a saint, but John and Basil were not. But Basil is one of the greatest monarchs of all time. Came of age, ruling, starting in 1025, died in 1025, 976, born in 958. So, but before he could stabilize any of the frontiers, the civil war had to end. And this is two oligarchic families. And one, Galeros. Both had the same first name. Basil was the oldest son of Romanos II, as we said. And actually, speaking of the Senate, it was the Senate that created this whole co-emperor idea. Didn't care about much, and he's not entirely relevant politically. At the time, we talked about the Senate, it was controlled by Basil Lekapenos. And one of the wealthiest men of the empire, who sought a revolutionary oligarchy. And his idea, of course, like so many of these guys, was to have, and that acted more or less as a figurehead that he could turn into then, a puppet that he can control. But both John I and Basil II, of the large landowners, it was bad enough they were able to escape taxes, that they were able to control, in fact, raise taxes privately, monasteries and everything else. It was just inefficient. The large estates were inefficient. There were absentee landowners, and land ended up laying idle. And both John and Basil destroyed this faction. But it came to a head with Bartas Skleros and Bartas Phokas. And as it turns out, you see this in many of the oligarchic states from Ukraine to the U.S., that Lekapenos, in times of warfare, in times of chaos, when warfare got out of control, military defeats, they were able to manipulate the system to take lands and assets that didn't belong to them. And the emperor, one of his central responsibilities was to uphold the law. Oligarchs, the whole principle of revolutionary oligarchy is that laws are something that we create for our interests, and only poor people have to follow them. Now, Bardas and Phokas, two oligarchs, had these. Skleros was defeated in 979, Phokas in 989, and it was a regular elite rebellion. And I'm not even going to say that they didn't mobilize every anti-imperial force they could, including the Paulicians. That certainly happened in France in the High Middle Ages, a few hundred years later. But of course, since oligarchy is the principle of self-interest, Phokas and Skleros turned on each other. And Skleros, after he was captured and rebellion began to fizzle out in 979-980, he spoke with Basil. And he made it very clear. He said, I know I raised a rebellion against you, but I am telling you here. And he was kind of trading his life for help against Phokas. Bardas Phokas. Don't get him confused with the emperor. Those are two different people. He said, never trust those with money. Never trust those who are powerful in the Senate. They will do anything, they will say anything to enrich themselves, and certainly at the expense of the empire, they will ally with anybody. Oligarchy was the anti-imperial, anti-Christian, anti-everything decent force, at war with nature, at war with natural law, and certainly anyone with a position of legitimate power that could tell them what to do, because there's nothing worse than that. And we know how that turned out in the West. He even went so far as to advise Basil to do whatever he could, legal or illegal, to destroy them. As you know, since I started this years and years and years ago, science is the master key to history, which is the battle between the nation or monarchy or the common good on the one side and the oligarchy is, wherever it shows itself, is generally commercial. Not always, but often commercial. It's monetized. It's obsessed with self-aggrandizement, individualism, rejection of law or anything that gets in the way of commerce, pure self-interest, ego inflation, and the rejection of anything above the person. That includes culture, religion, and natural law. They'll, as I said, lie, like Skleros himself said, they'll ally with anybody. In Russia, of course, it was the principle of Novgorod, attacked, unfortunately, both by Ivan III, well, actually, by Ivan III, Basil III, and Ivan the Terrible, because there simply was no other way to fight them except through military force. They are the antipode of the common good. And, of course, using one against the other is pretty important. So until they were finally subdued, there was a low-level civil war that did do a lot of damage to the empire. The victories of Islam often came in this period of time where there is chaos in the empire. Foreign enemies, as well as domestic enemies, could take advantage. So the Fatimid Caliphate, the treaty that the Byzantines had with them expired in 991. And a new ruling class there rejected the former, more or less, not an alliance, but at least peace with Byzantium, and started to attack the empire. The Hamdanid Emirate in Syria, which was a Byzantine protectorate, was attacked, and Aleppo fought the what was left of the Fatimid Caliphate. So you had three sides. But even early on in this three-way war, as you know, the Islamic civil wars were raging, these caliphates were much older, conservative, sometimes pro-Byzantine bodies. We're talking about people like Aziz Abdullah, who was a part of the Aleppo, the oligarch who ruled Aleppo, wanting it independent of these caliphates, were militantly opposed to Byzantium, where the older caliphates sought peace, not necessarily expansion. But once in a while, one of these would be taken over by somebody. They ended up defeating Byzantium, Orontes, and forcing Basil II to intervene, which was a huge shock. And the overcoming, Basil II even then had a ferocious reputation. And he eventually destroyed the strongholds of the Fatimids. And it didn't take long for them, for a new treaty to be signed and the caliphate to be more or less allied with Byzantium. But as this is going on, Aziz Abdullah was placed in charge of Aleppo. One of the first things he did is persecute Christians, which suggests to me that there's a very strong Jewish element there. He sought an independent Aleppo. So he was attacking both Fatimid and Byzantine bases. And
So ultimately, of course, you know, the Fatimids were run by a brand new Fakan Allah ruler on the one hand, and of course Aziz in Aleppo on the other. Playing them off against each other was not particularly difficult. And yet it cost the empire a tremendous amount. One of the big errors of the Crusaders, and this is something, you know, one of the reasons that the Crusaders failed, was that they didn't understand the very delicate balance between Islamic groups, or I say among Islamic groups in the Middle East. And that that crusade was called, the Fatimid Caliphate was a Byzantine protectorate. In fact, they were the buffer against more militant Islam, and of course, which we always united with Judaism. I mean, Islam always was, but militant leaders, the persecution of Christians, the consolidation of Islamic power was something that was not the policy of the caliphate, especially as they began to weaken, and civil wars among Islamic groups really sapped the strength of all of them. This is something that the Crusaders didn't understand. They just weren't up on this stuff. They were too far away, and they didn't, you know, the Byzantines were involved at every level with Islamic politics and playing one leader off against another. Now, Basil II is known for something else, and that is the defeat of Bulgaria. Bulgaria was one of the sources of orthodoxy for the early Russian Empire under St. Vladimir. However, Bulgaria and Byzantium slowly became enemies because you had constant, consistent raiding of Byzantine Greek-speaking territory for quite some time. And, of course, domestic issues had harmed Byzantium in the short term. This is why you had victories for Islam in the south and some victories for the Bulgarians in the north, which is why the domestic issue, domestic consolidation, was so extremely important. There is no military, legitimate military defense without a very strong sense of the common good and a strong monarchy. But the war that we're talking about really began in the year 1000. Under Basil, moved and scored victory after victory, Samuel, the very talented emperor of Bulgaria, invaded. Rather than mount a defense, he mounted an offense. And the Battle of Kledian in 1014, after Byzantium took Skopje and Vidin, the Sturma River, for the mountain pass, actually, an area chosen by Samuel to attack Byzantium. And, you know, part of the problem here is because of the defeats earlier on, as I mentioned, a lot of his nobility was running out of patience with him. And when you have a rapacious nobility, they tend to put pressure on the monarch. If you can't get this done, then we're going to have to take matters in our own hands. Led to the infamous blinding of the Bulgarians, which was a very stupid thing, was done under great pressure. So he was there thinking that this is really his last stand. And you had city after city voluntarily going under the Byzantines because, like the Roman Empire in the past, the people who voluntarily came under Byzantium were treated very well and were fully independent. Even more, their nobility was given Byzantine titles and placing commands of police forces and the army in certain areas. So after that massive defeat, the Belisitsa Mountain, Bulgarians were not able to replace their giant losses. And that was where the so-called blind march took place. And it had a good side in that more and more places voluntarily came under Byzantium, but it was a cruel, stupid thing. And it caused greater Bulgarian resistance. But as Bulgaria was tamed, you also had the acceptance of the Serbs
for, you know, indirect Byzantine control. And it brought the border of the empire all the way to the Danube. And outside of the blinding issue, most of you know that story. The numbers differ, but after the Belisitsia battle, blinded. I think the claim is 99 out of 100 were blinded, and the one that was left with sight, well, I think they had one eye, were then to lead them back to the capital with the idea that maybe this will save lives, because no one's going to want to resist if they think that Basil is a lunatic. But the resistance that came afterwards, which was hopeless from the Bulgarian side, it existed entirely because of the anger that that stunt caused. But ultimately, it was in the interest, not that issue, but the defeat of Bulgaria was in the interest of Bulgaria and Byzantium, since they were even more closely integrated into the Orthodox Commonwealth, which is, you know, the whole purpose of the empire externally. Then there's Khazaria. We're talking about a time after Svatoslav's victory over them. But they did have a rump state in Crimea after the, you know, after the main empire crumbled. George Tuzul led the remnant of the Khazars in the Crimea. He was eventually defeated in 1016. And of course, Mstislav of Chernigov took part in the war against him. And that really, rather than a defeat of the capital of Izil, that was the end of Khazaria as an organized political presence. I mean, the main force was defeated by Svatoslav in 969. This was a bit later. It should be noted that, I mean, the relations between Byzantium and Khazaria went back and forth. Sometimes, because Khazaria was always at war with the Arabs, because of that, there were many times where they were allies with the Byzantines. There were attempts to convert portions of the empire. There was at least one bishop there, but that changed whenever they were no longer at war with the Arabs. The whole point of Khazaria becoming Jewish was to declare their independence of both the Islamic movement and the Byzantine Orthodox one. It wasn't done for really any other reason, but they became dominant in the slave trade because that ideology, the proto-Talmudic ideology, gave them a justification. But certainly no concept of the common good existed. Now, the Byzantine writers, the Byzantine emperor himself, the name for Khazaria was Turkia. In other words, they were Turks, and they were seen as ethnic Turks. And the wars between Khazaria and the Arab, the Muslim organizations drained their resources, and not to mention also drained the resources of Islam. And I mentioned the Himyarite kingdom, which was founded a bit after 380 AD, which of course is much earlier than we're talking about here, but they're very, it's very significant. It was a small but very powerful Judaic kingdom that converted around 410, 420 under the monarch Assad. And it's significant to know that this kingdom converted to Judaism solely to organize their men to defeat the Greeks, to defeat Orthodoxy. And of course, the first thing they do is purge their society of Christians. And this is how they remained independent. The same thing for Khazaria. The Jewish pagan alliance was very clear. And of course, at this time, going back a few centuries, this is prior to the rise of Islam. And an argument I'm making here is that the Himyarite kingdom is one of the reasons that Islam spread, was financed as well as it was. He did force Judaism on the army, and then the army on the population. Now, there's, given the time period, that's not insane, because religion usually went along with whoever was victorious in battle Of course, that changed later on. And people tended to follow the religion of their rulers. So it wasn't seen as an individual choice. That developed later on. But at the time, religion was seen as the cement of the state, especially in Islamic and Jewish circles. You had many missionaries sent there, not just from the Byzantines or from the Roman, but elsewhere, being killed as time went on. The minute they converted to Judaism, they began persecuting Christians in every way. So we're talking about, 500 years before what we're talking about. But these families persisted. In fact, their persecution of Christians centuries earlier was so bad that a faction of Aksum, or we can call it Ethiopia today, attacked them from the West to stop this persecution. In fact, their own scribes at the time, Himyarite people said that this is a revenge for the hatred of Jews. So even then, they were making these very similar arguments. But Aksum eventually won. And the last, in terms of an organized political presence, Dun Nuwas was the last monarch of that small kingdom. And he went to his death despising Christianity and blaming them for his downfall. By 500, it doesn't matter if they didn't have a clear base of operations. By 500, so a few hundred years before what we're talking about here, those families from the Himyarite kingdom had a giant influence all over the Middle East, especially in Saudi Arabia. Given their money and given their cohesion, given the fact that they dominated the caravan routes, which of course was part of the rise of Islam, you cannot separate the Himyarite Jews from the rise of Islam in places like Saudi Arabia. Yes, they had to pay for a while a tribute to Aksum in Ethiopia. And of course, the initial Ethiopian invasion early on was solely because of the persecution of Christians of all types. And Christians did revolt against Jewish rule in the Himyarite kingdom. In response, of course, they burnt churches. And any concept of them being ruled by Christians as now Jewish converts was out of the question. Nothing was more disgusting to them. And this is very early on. They had barely absorbed that mentality. And still, almost their sole reason for existence was to destroy Christianity within its boundaries. And once they became a tributary state of Aksum, part of Ethiopia, you had a lot of rebellions against Christian rule. Because again, there's nothing worse than being ruled by Christians. They could not bear, and this is from mainstream historical sources, could not bear to be ruled, even indirectly, by Christians from Aksum or from anywhere else. I'm convinced that the Ethiopian position, the so-called Ethiopian Orthodox, eventually Monophysite position, was that the Himyarite kingdom, that form of Judaism and Islam are one and the same thing. Because, here you have an invasion that took place because so many Christians, many of them were from that area, called on them to save them. And the revolt against Ethiopian rule led to even more Christian persecution. The idea was to cleanse the place. Now, I connect them to Islam because they were able, the Khazars were able to control trade on the Volga and charging tolls, etc. That kind of conquest abroad and charging tolls was really the huge source. That's what they were for. That was the entire empire was based on controlling this kind of trade. Well, the Himyarite kingdom did the same thing with the caravan routes. I'm pretty sure this is not a coincidence. But since the domination of the caravan trade, which is where all the money was, is one of the things that gave Muhammad's movement a leg up, you had a fairly simple ideology to mobilize people. That's why it was so important that those routes be dominated by someone like Muhammad and his followers. But just prior to that, you had families from this kingdom also being able to block their movement from Southern Europe, no different than the Khazars were able to block trade on the Volga. This is then underscored by the idea that in the early years of Islam, of course, Islam, the minute they were created, they invaded their neighbors. You know, this was a military doctrine. This was state building more than anything else. But beyond that, it was also, they were a huge part of the financing of the Islamic conquests from almost the day it was founded, consistently. These families were wealthy and powerful. And because of this, you know, Judaic ideology now, they immediately became a commercial, but extremely violent, not just engaging in commerce, but trying to destroy anyone else engaging in commerce, which goes along with that whole mentality. Again, this is pure, this is oligarchy raised to a religion. So even by the 630s, 640s, families from the Himyarite kingdom, still very very coherent, very cohesive, and very wealthy, were a part of the financing of the expansion of Islam. Once that occurred, the Himyarite noble families, you know, 100% Judaic. Now, many of them, of course, pretended to be Muslims because there's not a huge difference between those two things. But people like Dzu Abbas, Dzu Kola, they became the most influential families in Syria, and even the mainstream sources will tell you they're the most influential family in Saudi Arabia just before Islam and then just after the foundation of Islam. And they were also involved in either starting or ending all the three periods of the Islamic civil wars early on. None of this, of course, can be a coincidence. Most people have never heard of the Himyarite kingdom. It's a concept I've been toying with for some time. I got to do more work on it, but it's extremely important. Now, I bring all of this up because it fits very neatly into the battle between oligarchy and monarchy that people like Basil II, Ivan the Fourth in Russia, and so many others, even Nicholas I in the 19th century, this is how they cut their teeth. Without the war against oligarchy, there can be no functional state. That the oligarchs even raised a revolt in Georgia, and we'll come in a bit later, under the rule of Basil II. In fact, some of the Georgians backed the oligarchic revolts of 987. You know, property to the oligarchs at any era is a double-edged sword. Remember, laws only apply to them. A law is not something that exists in nature. It's pure sophistry, in the literal sense of the ancient Greek sophist. Everything is conventional. Nothing is natural. That's the connection between oligarchy on the one hand and social liberalism and leftism, even right up to our own day. Everything is conventional. Nothing is natural. That's the foundation. Of course, that's the foundation of nominalism, too. Nominalism as such was not necessarily something with a label at the time. It was simply implied as a matter of course. Basil II and anyone else, John, for anyone else involved in the repression of oligarchy and the oligarchs that lead these rebellions, everything is based on violence and coercion, whether financial or military. And don't forget, especially in Byzantium, some of these large landholders, just like in Russia under Ivan IV, had private armies. They had their own intelligence. They were kind of like the cartel leaders in Latin America up until recently. They even had their own air force, you know, in the 20th, 21st century. Back then, they had everything that a state would have, creating, of course, a state within a state. But the only claim to rule was the fact that usually through dishonest means, they were able to gain more wealth than those around them. The internal revolts, wherever it might be found, derives from, against someone like Basil II, or against even Byzantine interests in the Middle East, especially when it comes to commerce, come from the oligarchic mentality. Because if you're going to raise a rebellion against a state for your own aggrandizement, you already have to be an oligarch. But even then, they were making a claim to an open society, just like the Judaizing sects, Paulicians. They spoke in very Protestant terms. So what does it mean for the central government? Small and medium-sized property owners had to be protected. I mentioned that the large landowners were very inefficient, that they were absentee, that because they were involved in so many other things, they couldn't concentrate on one area. They left employees in charge of lands that often were left fallow, which means that small and medium-sized landowners were the backbone of the empire, just like they were the backbone of American society early on. In fact, that whole idea, that very loyal, royalist, and still independent-minded idea, based on the common good, however, so-called yeomanry, is at the center. And rulers like Basil II had to protect them at all costs. Because, as I mentioned, the Lekapenos and those who ruled the Senate a bit earlier here took advantage of periods of instability to aggrandize themselves. We see what's happened within a few months after the nonsensical COVID lockdowns. Within a few months, you had a huge increase in billionaires and a massive increase in the wealth, not just Bezos, but, you know, people like Bill Gates and all the rest. We know why this is. But in all of these cases, they're able to take advantage of a period of chaos when everyone else is occupied with other things to continually parlay their wealth into greater and greater wealth, which amounts to destroying their competition, shutting down small and middling landholders, whether it be landholders or today, small and medium businesses. The relationship is strikingly similar. Point being, it was the small landowners that was the core of the army, both in terms of manpower as well as food and supplies. So the empire certainly had an interest in defending these people, which is another way of saying, if the oligarchs were to win, and they did temporarily, you know, it was back and forth, throughout the empire, you would have a situation like in early modern Poland. I've talked about Poland many, many times on this show and many others. It was as close to a fully oligarchic empire that you can get. The only real foreign policy was done through confederations of powerful families. These powerful families were not nobles. There wasn't a high level of literacy among them, which is why they eventually brought in the Jews to take care of their books, so to speak, in the cities, which is how Poland, the Polish Empire, ended up holding about 80% of the world's Jewish population, starting in the 15th and then 16th centuries. This is what oligarchs do. They debase the society. A noble class can only develop properly under a strong monarchy, because only the monarchy can justify and hallow their positions. Their positions only make sense under a monarchy. 996, the decree on property ownership stated that whenever you have the poor as well as small landowners falling behind on their taxes, the rich had to pay them. There's going to be no shirking of any tax duties. We talked about that already. But it also, you can only get so much out of small landowners. They have to be solvent. So this decree forced the wealthy to pay for those who had built up arrearages for legitimate reasons. Unfortunately, the oligarchs rising again after the end of Basil's reign, they got together and elected Romanos III, who, of course, immediately repealed all of this. the problem is an eternal one, because it's very difficult to maintain an anti-oligarchic system. The oligarchs always, you know, because they have no right to rule, they become very good at manipulation and propaganda. They know how to manipulate people. This is how they got their wealth in the first place. Honest work doesn't lead to you being an oligarch. Dishonest work leads you. And even if by some miracle you became one of these people honestly, you can't maintain it honestly. You now have every incentive. And you end up having Thomas Hobbes's world of individuals constantly at war with each other. And I mentioned that the oligarch rebellion early on in this talk was won by those guys turning on each other. There's no honor. There's no loyalty. There's no virtue. There's only commerce. And usually by dishonest means. But by Basil's death, 1025, he had 14.4, almost 15 million nosmata in the treasury. Oligarchy drains the treasury. Oligarchy privatizes public wealth. I've always defined postmodern capitalism, and I think this is the key to understanding. The myth is that the capitalist will win if he serves the public good. In other words, if he responds to the market better than his competitors. That may have existed at some point. It's mostly a theoretic market relation. Now, in postmodern capitalism, oligarchy, I should say, they create markets, they don't respond to them. What matters the most is the person who can socialize costs and privatize profits in the most efficient way. That's who wins. And it was no different back then. Monarchy, nationalism, common good, however you want to put it, in Plato's sense of the term, overflows the treasury because the public remains public. Right after Basil's death and the oligarchs recovered, elected Romanos III, the exact opposite happened. They ended up privatizing what was at one time the public, you know, the commonwealth, literally, the public wealth. So even from an economic point of view, oligarchy fails. Oligarchy is a perversion. Of course, there's a legitimate place for a real nobility. That class, not defined by wealth, but ability. Their dedication to the common good, whether it be as scholars or as clergy or as generals or something like that. What a real senate was supposed to be, not just a talking shop for the wealthy. In fact, it became a talking shop because that's all it was a place where oligarchs were to be found. Peter the Great did the exact same thing when he founded St. Petersburg, created the Senate and staffed it with his people, and it became kind of like a Supreme Court. Didn't have a whole lot of power other than that, though. The army loved Basil. He was immensely popular. He instituted pensions for families of fallen soldiers. Anything you could think of, we kind of take for granted, came from centralizing popular monarchist or nationalist is to be a populist. Defending those who are at war with middling landholders. There is very little that Basil II and dynasty didn't do. The strength that to the sacking in 1204 comes from the victory and his rule. The problem is, as I've said 100 times before, that this can't be institutionalized. Populist ruler like Basil dies to maintain this, because institutions are controlled by people, and people have passions and fantasies about power. So it really doesn't matter what kind of system you have. I mean, the Russians in the 19th century were a monarch after another. Succession rule. certain landholders in the provinces, offices fall to that temptation, and the only thing that kept them in check was a strong military ruler. It's no accident that so many of the third world countries that became first world, oligarchy destroys an economy. And have an economy thrive. And in one form or another, that same mentality existed wherever oligarchs went, because they needed this office as lawyers and accountants, and denied, of course, they didn't want any rule natural law. Ultimately, they have to deny Christ, they have to deny everything, the connection between the rejection of Logos and the Judaistic idea. And that's what this talk has really been about. And how that actually worked, how time in Byzantine history. Thank you, everyone, as always, for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.